We have the great privilege tonight of listening to a man who himself is a convert and who himself has gone through this journey, which he will soon tell you about. Mr. Frank Schaefer is the editor of the Christian Activist newspaper. We have copies here for you. They're free. Please take one up if you have not read it before. As well, he is a film producer and a noted author. I would like to just note two of his most recent books, Portofino, which is a fiction work produced, published by Macmillan. It is here for sale as well. And fresh off the press is the story, the wonderful story of his journey to Orthodoxy. And it is entitled Dancing Alone, The Quest for Orthodox Faith in an Age of False Religion. It's published by Holy Cross, and it is as well here for sale. It is a great honor for us to have tonight speaking for us Mr. Frank Schaefer.
Good evening. The topic tonight on my journey to Orthodoxy is one that I could cover a number of ways. The short answer as to why I became Orthodox might be, well, because it seemed like a good idea at the time. A longer answer would be found here in Dancing Alone, which I will refer to tonight, not only to try to induce you to buy a few copies before you leave, but also because it actually has something to do with this talk, and there are things in Dancing Alone that I can develop at length, which obviously, in the format of one speech, you cannot. Somewhere in between lies the talk that I'll give you tonight, which will neither be in-depth enough, given the scope of the subject matter, or brief enough, but hopefully will at least whet your appetite not to be interested in my journey, which is really of no consequence whatsoever, but in the Orthodox Church itself, which is of great consequence. And I do hope that those of you who are here tonight who are not in the Orthodox Church will at least leave somewhat more interested in what Orthodoxy is all about. To help me phrase my remarks properly tonight, it would be helpful if I could see a show of hands to give me an idea of how this room divides up between those of you who are Orthodox and those of you who are not. How many people here, or should I ask rather, the people who are not Orthodox to just put your hands up? And those of you who are Orthodox, I presume, are the rest. Let me see your show of hands. Okay, fine. I like to do that because then if only two or three other people put up their hands, I'd wonder what everyone else was. Maybe Unitarians or something. I don't know. You can put your hands up for both that way. My own journey to Orthodoxy did not begin with some stunning revelation or an interest in the Orthodox Church. I began my journey towards the historic church, towards Orthodoxy, without having any idea whatsoever that I was on a journey or where I would wind up. It was a most inauspicious beginning for something that had, for me at least, a very joyful and resounding ending. My own journey began not because I was looking for Orthodoxy, but because I was growing increasingly restless within the Protestant community for reasons unrelated, I thought at the time, to anything to do with the historical church. Had you told me back in the late 1970s, when I suppose this search began, if I had to put a date on it, somewhere around 1978, let's say, that the questions I was beginning to ask would inexorably lead me down a path that would take me out of the Protestantism that I had been raised in as Francis and Edith Schaefer's son in Legree Fellowship in Switzerland, in a Christian home known around the world as a place where people came to a study community called Legree Fellowship for answers to serious questions, answers from a biblical perspective, a Protestant perspective. If you had told me that my dissatisfaction with certain things about that inheritance and the world around me would eventually have led me, of all places, into the Greek Orthodox Church of Newburyport, Massachusetts, I would have laughed in your face. For one thing, I was living in Switzerland at the time. For another, I knew nothing about Greek Orthodoxy other than to think it must have been something like the kind of Greek version of the Roman Catholics, although they just wore different and even funnier hats. And that would have been my only real knowledge of Orthodoxy as distinct from sort of everything papist or Roman, which I would have lumped all together at that point in my life, having no real knowledge, for that matter, about the Roman Catholic Church either, except that this was the thing from which we Protestants had come and, I suppose, rediscovered or reinvented Christianity after all the corruption in the Roman Catholic Church. But nevertheless, my own journey began, unwittingly or not, when I began to question certain elements of received wisdom, I suppose, from my own upbringing within Protestantism, and also certain elements about the world around me, particularly these United States, that I was spending an increasing amount of time in, both speaking and making film projects such as How Should We Then Live with my father, a project on the history of philosophy and art from a Protestant biblical perspective, or Whatever Happened to the Human Race with Dr. C. Everett Koop, who recently was Surgeon General, on medical ethics, issues of abortion, infanticide, euthanasia from a biblical perspective. But in the midst of these projects, certain questions, certain gnawing doubts began to arise that led eventually to becoming Orthodox, but as I say, at the time, I had no idea that's where it would go. And I guess I should divide these types of questions or doubts into two categories. One would be intensely personal, and the other more intellectual and historical. On the intensely personal side, I can just kind of sum it up by saying that I increasingly felt that I was not being given any tools whereby to grow as a Christian. I increasingly felt that there was a great dichotomy, a division between the kind of public persona that I cut in terms of some of the books I was writing, things I was saying, and my own life. It seemed as if other than the fact that I would have claimed to have been a Christian and quote-unquote saved, there was no spiritual progress in the sense that my own passions, my own temptations, my own demons, as it were, seemed to be unconquerable. And that I would occasionally hit certain spiritual highs where one would kind of try to rev yourself up to feel more spiritual and rededicate your life to the Lord, quote unquote. And this would go on for a little while, reviving one's interest in having a, quote, morning quiet time. But the fact of the matter was, as a Protestant Christian, though I didn't know it at the time, my gnawing doubt, my lack of progress, was related to the fact that I was not given the sacramental tools or the apostolic tools or the tools that one is given within the historic church to grow as a Christian. For me, just to give you an example, confession was a lonely muttered prayer as I fell asleep into my pillow. And the good thing about my pillow was, is it never asked me any questions, and it never demanded I change very much. God, to whom theoretically I was confessing, never showed up and asked for an accounting, never asked me if I had modified my behavior in some way, had changed the way I was treating my wife or my children or whatever it would have been I was confessing. And so it was a convenient arrangement, but a very lonely one. The other set of questions, on the not-so-personal side, although all things have personal bearings, was more of an intellectual question. And that was, in the 70s, I was intensely involved in what was called the rise of the new religious right in this country. If you had turned on your TV set at some point, you might have well seen me, for instance, for a week, 5 days in a row, on the 700 Club with Pat Robertson, doing a whole series on the whole pro-life issue, where I would have been talking about what was happening in the issue of abortion and infanticide, what was happening, say, to Dr. C. Everett Koop, in the way he was being ostracized by the medical profession for taking a stand for human life, and related issues. You might have heard me on Dr. Dobson's program, and indeed I remember he gave away about 175,000 copies of one of my first books called A Time for Anger, and it became his fundraising fulfillment. And you might have heard me doing a series of four or five programs in a row talking about this. And moreover, you would have found me in the role of working with people like my father and Dr. Koop and others, facilitating their ministry in the sense of using some of my interests in the film business and in writing to take their message to a wider audience. And so, somewhat through my own work, not that I was a very big fish in the evangelical pond, but in my own little corner of the muddy puddle, I was doing my thing, like a lost sort of tadpole that hasn't quite grown legs. But I was also attached to some bigger fish, like my dad, and I grew up at a dinner table where it was no big deal to have Billy Graham drop by or other people like that and sit down for lunch, and I thought this was all par for the course. But I remember that on the philosophical, historical kind of question, what I began to form in my mind was a question that went something like this. With all the money being spent and all the sound and fury of professional religiosity of which I was a part, or a small part, or contributing, and with the fact that there is more talk about religion than ever in this culture, perhaps, than before, you have the advent of the rise of religious television and televangelism and so forth, why is it, with all this smoke and fire and sound and fury, that the culture itself, whenever measured in any manner in which could be biblically relevant to this idea of judging something by the fruit it bears, is moving diametrically and in increasing speed in the very opposite direction of all this triumphalist claims about the number of people being born again and saved and how many stations every television program is on and so forth? And I remember once a kind of a strange juxtaposition, I forget when this was, maybe 79 or 80, reading a recent Gallup poll in which, as usual, 90-some percent of the American people were claiming to believe in God and the afterlife and the human soul, and something like 68 or 72 percent, I think it was in the high 60s if I remember right, were saying they had had a, quote, born-again experience at some point. I remember the juxtaposition of those statistics with statistics that told me that the same people who believed in God 90-some percent of the time, or whatever it was, and 68% of which had had a born-again experience, many of whom were driving around with bumper stickers plastered all over their car saying things like, read the book, or I found it, or whatever it might be, that this same population was aborting one-third of its babies, that this same population was seeing 50% of its marriages end in divorce, that this same population was throwing away their born children into everything from daycare centers to failed educational institutions that could neither teach people to read or behave in a civilized manner and seem more adept at teaching eighth graders how to use condoms than how to do mathematics. And that this very same religious, fervent, born-again, God-fearing people, right off the revivalist circuit-riding trail, with all their thousands of denominations and billions of dollars poured into these religious activities. For instance, I remember in my own lifetime, and it's a pretty short lifetime, watching the mom-and-pop operation of the so-called Christian Booksellers Association go out of church basements into glittering storefronts and then turn into multi-million dollar chains and then finally turn into the Christian Booksellers Association that today does $3.5 billion worth of business annually and is as big as the ABA, which is the Secular American Booksellers Association. I saw that happen in the space of a few years, from the late 60s to early 80s. And yet in the middle of all this, the culture in which all this religiosity was taking place, because America is a very religious culture, nevertheless was moving diametrically in the opposite direction of any stated first principle of Christian life. And while there was a great deal of talk about Christianity and committing your heart to Jesus and so forth and so on, when it got down to the Christian life itself, and I forget when I made this kind of connection, the culture itself seemed to be in the same place I was as a personal individual. And that was, yes, we, the culture, and me personally, had religion, and yes, we claimed we were religious and we believed something, and yes, it was called Christianity. But there was an element missing, and a big element, and that is that somehow the belief The born-again experience, the religion, the commitment, did not lead to changed lives being lived differently on a daily basis, wherein the culture, all these 68% of born-again people, or me personally, Frank Schaefer running around giving speeches and writing books, were moving more towards Christ and being Christ-like rather than away from him. And if anything is true about the contemporary American culture, it is that even within our own lifetimes, no matter how young a person is here, no matter how young you are, you have seen a devolution in which your society has gone from a post-Christian culture further towards an outright pagan culture, hostile to the very first premises of Christianity. We have moved beyond post-Christianity. We are now into the post-modern age, hostile to any idea of absolutes at all. The only absolute being in our culture that there are absolutely no moral absolutes. That is the only American absolute. It is the worship of pure relativism. It is the absolute deification, if you like, of pragmatism as the first principle of national life and pluralism. No country on earth, judged by its fruits or its actual life, as in what does it do with its babies? How does it educate its children? What does it do with its families? It's ever produced a climate more hostile to Christian living, for all the fact that there are 1,000 churches, it seems, in every town, and white spires rising beautifully from the New England countryside that I live in, and mega churches dotting the West Coast, and vast factory-like buildings that are carved churches with 15 and 20,000 members all over the Midwest, notwithstanding, in terms of the level of actual practice where judged by any moral or biblical standard that one would care to apply, our culture is producing, as it were, the ethics and the life of the gulag, not the ethics and the life of a free society in which the sanctity of life and individual worth as people created in the image of God is honored. The only difference is that because there is this fictitious maintenance of a kind of a middle class status quo, where some of the people, some of the time, think they are happy, and the fact that a lot of our skullduggery and malfeasance is done out of sight and therefore out of mind, your average family on their way to Disneyland does not stop by the big teaching hospital and pry open the lid of the dumpster and count the bodies of the aborted babies. Nor do any of us worry too much about the fact that a certain percentage of our tax dollars are now used on fetal experimentation, wherein babies are kept alive after abortion for the only purpose of having their cells experimented on, tissue removed, organs removed, etc., etc., and it's your money paying for it. And so, I guess to sum it up, in terms of the direction of the culture vis-a-vis its religiosity, a thought began to occur to me, and I guess this was the beginning of the end in my happy, unthinking involvement with the Protestant effort to bring America back to God, because I began to wonder, who's God? The God began to look a lot more like Molech than anything that I had read about in the Beatitudes of the New Testament. The fact of the matter is that in looking at this culture and in looking at my own life, and looking at the culture in particular in terms of this example, I began to see very clearly that talk about Christianity and the use of Christian lingo is not necessarily Christianity itself. I began to see very clearly that you can be a very religious people, but if the religion is the wrong religion, it can also be a very pagan people. The Romans, after all, were intensely religious. That's why they prosecuted and persecuted the Christians, not because they were secularists, but because the Christians refused to worship Caesar. In our culture, a very similar situation has emerged. We have plenty of religion, in contrast to, say, Europe, which following the Reformation in a short few hundred or so years, devolved into total secularism, I guess more courageously secular than we are, in the sense that they didn't even keep up the pretense of pretending to be religious people. They just became secular humanists, whereas our deist, humanist, secular background kept up this pretense, like Thomas Jefferson, for instance, or Ben Franklin did, wherein we use God words, like we put stuff on our coins, in God we trust, for instance, okay? Then we go spend those same coins to pay for fetal experimentation. It's as if we can have in our nation Auschwitz and Disneyland next to each other. We just sort of keep them in different parts of town. But the fact of the matter is that once you begin to look at our own contemporary culture from the point of view of seeing that talk about Christianity and religious words are not necessarily the same thing as truth, forget the word religion or even Christianity, then you, of course, have opened the barn door and all the horses are going to run out, because then the natural logic is, what is truth? And if what this is, this amalgam of humanistic and enlightenment thinking combined with this millennialistic Puritan idea, the city set on the hill, if what this has produced is modern secular America, then what exactly was the engine of secularization? And I can remember moving from my original kind of uneasiness to a certain certainty. And that was this. I remember back in the late 1970s, for instance, the old bugaboo would be something like this. You would say, well, I mean, it wouldn't be put this crudely, but the idea was something like this. America was a nice, God-fearing Christian country, and then along came the ACLU and the National Organization of Women, maybe on the second voyage of the Mayflower, and they screwed it all up. Because we were all just God-fearing, good folks, everybody believed in Jesus, and we were all on our way. And then a bunch of secular humanists arrived in New York and started the New York Times and the Village Voice, and the whole thing went to hell in a handcart. And if it wasn't for Los Angeles and the media, and if it wasn't for New York and a bunch of activist judges in Washington and these godless politicians, left to ourselves, we're pretty good, decent, God-fearing people. There's nothing much wrong, as Bill Clinton said in his inaugural speech when he was elected president. He says, there's nothing wrong with America that America can't cure. George Bush said the same thing in his last State of the Union speech. He said, we are a good people. We have a wonderful fiction about our own goodness and about the rightness of this culture, as if somehow there's a fundamental heartland somewhere where there are all good, God-fearing folks, and it's just that little minority in New York City or wherever the figment of our imagination may be, some university professor or whatever, a feminist, and they're messing it all up. But if you look at American history, there is no they and there is no we. It's all us. And the fact of the matter is, the bed which the conservative, Bible-believing Protestant doesn't want to sleep on anymore is a bed he and she made. This country was not settled by the ACLU. This country's founding documents were written by people who predate the modern liberalism we all abhor. And there may have been plenty of God talk and God words and real Christians, by the way, on a journey towards Christ. But one thing that is very evident is that the roots of this culture are not Christian, in the sense that Christianity cannot be mixed with anything else. We are told that Christ is exclusivist. And when you have people like Ben Franklin taking nail scissors and Jefferson taking nail scissors to cut the name of Christ out of their Bibles so that they won't corrupt their children with these ideas, and when you have the kind of humanism that came from the French Enlightenment going back into the Renaissance before that, and when you have the kind of Protestantism that came out of the Reformation, where it's sola scriptura and everybody can just do their own thing based on the Bible and you just kind of make your own interpretation and Jesus speaks to your heart and you do your own thing as an individual, and you mix that up in a nice big old broth, what you get is modern America. This weird amalgam or mixture of strains from Puritan Christianity, Quakerism, something left from the historical church kind of as an echo in terms of absolutes and discussions of absolutes, a totally humanistic basis of a view of the world wherein science, knowledge, progress, and the future are going to lead us out of our problems, and God need not apply. God has been relegated, not as Nietzsche would have him, murdered or dead, but simply kicked upstairs like the person we dump into the old folks' home to be visited on weekends once in a while to remind us what our childhood was once about. That is the status God occupies in American civil religion. We show up once in a while, a couple holidays a year, we visit him, and we let the old man say a word or two, and then we get on with our lives, and the business of America is business, as everyone has always known, and God need not apply. The fact of the matter is, when you begin to look at our country and where it came from and you begin to see its problems, this fictitious right-wing bizarre idea that somehow America is a wonderful place and a few bad people have screwed it up and otherwise it would be fine, and almost, as Abraham Lincoln said, the almost chosen people, the city set on the hill, this millennial concept that we almost were the new Israel. The fact of the matter is, this was not screwed up in the 1920s. This was not derailed by the ACLU and Planned Parenthood. This was not, the derailment of American culture did not come about because of a few judicial activists. All these people played a small role. The derailment occurred before America was even founded. It occurred in the 16th century with the break between Protestantism and the Roman Catholic Church. And that break occurred because of the corruption within the Roman papacy and the system of the Roman Catholic Church. And that break itself was only possible because deeper into history, as you'll see if you read Dancing Alone, I have quite a bit of material on this, there was a break between the Eastern and the Western Church, which shattered the unity of Christendom. And our problems today, like all parts of history, believe it or not, we Americans are so ahistorical. We sometimes think that I guess this country just arrived from another planet in maybe 1968, which is about as far back as anybody seems to be able to remember, depending on what they were smoking in 1968. But the fact of the matter is, the problems of our culture are deeply rooted into moral, philosophical, and religious concerns, and the fact that most Americans have no idea what you're talking about, no idea change or to stand against the current, because we have no idea which way the wind's blowing or where it came from, so we just drift along with whatever's happening, like all these fads that sweep the Protestant community all the time, where it's the charismatic movement this month, and now they're all rolling in the aisles having laugh and praise worship services the next, and maybe that'll solve our problems, or maybe it's Reformed theology and the theonomists and this kind of thing, and we just kind of are buffeted looking for these answers and picking up any kind of bit of flotsam and jetsam that floats by, hoping this will take us somewhere. A lot of this is the result of the fact that we don't understand where we ourselves have come from. For me, in looking at the culture and in looking at my own life and seeing that these questions were somewhat synonymous, this unrootedness, the fact that America's own beginnings were not this simple fairy tale of a bunch of Christians showing up on Plymouth Rock, and then some atheist Jews arrived in New York in a speedboat a few hours later and set up an alternative organization and undermined it. The problem goes back before anybody arrived here at all, and the Native Americans were still living here unmolested, right back into the heart of European culture, where a papacy developed between the 6th and the 9th century so that the Roman Church became a political entity and a rival of all the other bishops of the world, thus breaking the canonical and collegial system that the church had had from the apostles. The roots go back to that, and they go back into the Reformation that was a rebellion against the ultimate political corruption of that body known as the Roman Catholic Church. And they go back to people like Martin Luther, who within his own lifetime, knowingly or unknowingly, as John Calvin and the other reformers did as well, did not reform the Roman Catholic Church, but formed an alternative religion that became a rival of the ancient church, both East and West. Our problems go back to a group of people who began to truly believe that the individual, with his reason alone, without recourse to the church, without recourse to history, without recourse to submitting in some humility to the body of Christ, to take a Bible and open it and figure out for himself or herself whatever it was God wanted to tell them. And the fact that everybody figured out something different, well, so be it. Then we'll all just go our different ways and we'll have Swedenborgians and we will have New Lights and Universalists and Quakers and Brethren and Plymouth Brethren. And according to the latest United Nations statistics of 1989, now 23,000 Protestant denominations worldwide, with an average of 5 new sectarian groups formed a week. So be it, as long as it can just be me and my Bible, sola scriptura, just me and Jesus. And don't let anybody get in the way of what my Jesus wants to tell me, because if I have to be accountable to anyone, then I can't just do my own thing. I'm not an autonomous creature anymore. This spirit of rebellion is present at the source of the American experiment, at the very beginning. And it
may have been religious in terminology, but it was as far away from the ancient practices of the historical church as our secular pagans are today, whether Christ's name was theoretically honored or not. Because Christ himself did not leave a chaotic situation if you read the book of Acts. And if you read the church fathers, you will find that there was order and discipline, and in fact, there would have been no reason for the epistles to be written had not Paul and Peter and the others expected to be obeyed in an orderly and disciplined fashion. I got some water here. If you can just bring it up here. This is Jim Bouffier, by the way. Do you know Jim, everybody? Publishes The Christian Activist. Thank you. Brings me water once in a while. And as I began to look at some of these questions that I was having and some of the beginnings of American history, I realized, and I can put a closer date on this, back in around 1984, 1985, that I had gone about as far down the path of the evangelical movement, quote unquote, as I cared to go in good conscience, because essentially every fundraising letter I was sending out at that point was a lie. It was a lie because I didn't believe it anymore. Not had lost my faith as a Christian, but I wasn't signing on anymore. Whatever this was, I wasn't part of this. I didn't know what I ever wanted to be part of or whether I ever would be part of anything again. But this individualistic, do your own thing, sola scriptura type of Christianity, this insanity of denominational schism and pluralism, you talk about where the idea of modern pluralism came from. It was not a bunch of deconstructionist literary critics at UCLA, it was a bunch of theologians saying we can all find our own way in the scripture. The whole pluralistic impulse, the whole deconstructionist impulse, the whole radical reduction of truth down to textual and linguistic analysis, my friends, was not invented by secularists, it was invented by Protestant theologians. And whatever this was, I wasn't buying anymore. And so Jim, over here, who just brought this glass of water up, who was running Schaefer Productions with me, we had made a number of things, like Whatever Happened to the Human Race. We both kind of ran out of steam at the same time, not exactly knowing why, and we kind of drew a line under it and went off and made some movies in the secular film business, figuring that it would be better to do something you were interested in and had some creative possibilities and some integrity in the sense that you weren't lying to anybody, except the actors, of course, and you always have to lie to them when you're making a movie. But other than that, and that's just par for the course, because actors aren't really people, you know. But that's another discussion, as Hitchcock would say. So it's not really lying, you know. But anyway, other than that, we both kind of figured at about the same moment that whatever this was, we just couldn't go any further. So the donors for Schaefer Productions back in those days were somewhat stunned when they started getting return mail, including return checks. Because there's one thing you never do in the Christian world. You don't send the checks back uncashed. And we did. And we were raising back in those days about $2 million a year. And it wasn't a big ministry as ministries go, but it was big enough so it paid some health insurance bills and other nice things. And when we started just drawing the line under it, it was kind of shook us up. But it also freed us up in the sense that from that point on, things got very serious in terms of the personal journey because we were kind of putting our money where our mouth was and in winding down this Protestant ministry and in beginning to really look at the basics again, we were free to be honest, if you want to put it that way, without having to think about, well, what will the donors think? What will this and what will that? It was just individuals looking for something. And so both Jim and I, in tandem, without organizing anything, started doing a lot of reading of things we had never done before, particularly church history. And the thing that amazed me was in reading the church history, forget whether Christianity is true or not, the same history that a pagan would be reading, interested in the subject merely academically, I began to discover a history in a church that I knew nothing about. And you can put this down to arrogance, if you like, but I was amazed that I knew nothing about this, not because I think I know everything, although my wife might differ with that, but because I had been raised in Francis Schaeffer's home. And we had even gone off and made series like How Should We Then Live on the history of philosophy and ideas. And I thought, well, if anybody in the Protestant community is going to know something about where the church came from, I must know something. I never really stopped to think, do I? Because after all, I'm supposed to be the son of a Protestant intellectual. We are supposed to know things. And wasn't I taught all this? I found my own knowledge of church history being a little facetious when something like this. When I began to analyze it compared to real church history, it went like this. There was an early church in which they simply worshiped Christ in spirit, maybe sing a simple hymn, bang a tambourine or something, but it was all pure and wonderful. That much we knew. And there was no papacy or bishops or anything organized or liturgy or ritual. Ritual would have been the big word. Even bigger word would have been man-made traditions. None of that. They just had the Bible, probably the King James Version, Old and New Testament. They stood on the Word, so I could picture each Christian in the church opening up the Book of Ephesians. I knew those old bishops came along, changed everything, added all this stuff. I don't know exactly when, but I knew a lot had been added because we were like the early church and guys that were doing this other mumbo-jumbo were different, so they must have added something. Then nothing happened for 1,500 years. I guess there were no Christians. Kind of died out. And then Martin Luther or someone found a Bible or translated one or did something with the Bible. I wasn't sure what. And after they did that thing, it all got going again. And then we were right like the early church again. And then nothing happened for a while because the Reformation's own history is sort of ignored and muddy because nobody wants to talk about the wars of religion that swept over Europe as all the Protestant sects started slaughtering each other. So nothing happened after Martin Luther. He found the Bible again. And then all of a sudden, Charles Finney and Moody and Sankey came along. And now it's the 19th century. And we almost remember that because my grandfather was a China Inland Mission missionary. And Hudson Taylor would have been one of the only biblical figures we knew about. And then it was Billy Graham came along. Because after that, you kind of forget the names between Finney and Moody. And then there's Billy Graham. And he's not all that great because he sort of compromised with the Roman Catholics and had a bishop pray on his podium or something in his 1966 New York crusade. So really, it's just us because we're not sure about him either. And right here in our own work, there's three us and two of us are sure about ourselves. But this other guy isn't quite a spiritual kindred spirit because he has a weird view of predestination and free will and maybe didn't go to the right seminary. Maybe. We have our suspicions. And that was it. Now that's facetious, but not very. So as I began to read Eusebius, for instance, his 4th century history of the church, and as I began to read Ignatius of Antioch, and as I began to read Clement, and as I began to read Polycarp and Irenaeus, and as I began to read the Didache, and as I began to go through the books that were written by those who were actually taught by the apostles, and as I began to read the New Testament itself, again, in the light of how it had been received by those to whom it was written before there even was a canon, and as I began to discover things like that, that the church itself, for more than 300 years, had been the canon of the New Testament, and that if you wouldn't trust its tradition, you had no Bible either, because it was the very bishops of the tradition you don't trust that decided what your New Testament Bible was. As I began to actually read church history and found that I really knew nothing about it, I started wondering if there was such a thing as the historical church that had somehow survived, and if it could be found. And I began to wonder what the quality of my own Christianity was, not in the sense of being saved or lost, which is a mystery, and only God knows the heart, but in the sense of being aligned with the body of Christ through history. What exactly was it I was doing on Sunday? And after reading for 2 or 3 years, to my amazement, I drew a couple very radical conclusions, at least radical for me at that point. And one was this, and that is that whatever it was that we were doing in terms of our New Testament Christianity within the Protestant community, it would have been unrecognizable to all those people I had been reading about. And I didn't decide that on the basis of a whim or theology or some verse that spoke to my heart, but simply on the good, basic, recorded history of the early church, its liturgies and its sacraments that are very well recorded and well attested to by the whole history of the church. And I guess I would put it this way. It occurred to me one day that if you had taken a peasant from 2nd or 3rd century Carthage and a Coptic Christian from the African church in the 4th or 5th century, and if you had taken a Byzantine Christian from the height of the Byzantine Empire, let's say in the 10th century, or even if you had taken a Roman Catholic Christian in the Western church, even during the corrupted period of the Renaissance, and you had brought them all together in a room and flown them in a time machine to your average evangelical Protestant American church circa 1990s or 1980s, literally, and I don't mean this facetiously or euphemistically, and I'm not talking about anything so unimaginative of as clothes or not knowing how electric lights work. I mean something more basic than that. Language problems aside, they could have stood in a whole church service and never known where they were, literally, because there would have been nothing to tell them that this was Christian worship. And if you had asked them where they were, depending on their, quote, worship experience, their answers may have ranged from positive things. They might have said, I was in a fine Bible study. We were in an interesting lecture. We were in a circus. We were in a carnival. We were in a fundraising event. But not one of them would have said we were in a Christian church. Not one of them would have said it's Sunday morning and this is church. And I mean that literally, and I'll tell you why. Because everything recognizable to them would have been absent. There would have been no clue. Because without an altar, without a service that is Eucharistically centered, without a chalice, without a paten, without the bread of peace, without a censer, by the way, from the second half of the second century on in the Church of Carthage, if you want to look at the archaeological museum in the Louvre, without icons, if you want to go to the Catacomb of Priscilla from the year 100 to 120 in Rome, no catacomb worth its salt where they had any residency at all other than a night or two was without its images. Without the whole focus of the service being based on the liturgy, well known, going right back into the Old Testament church, the church that Christ went to in the synagogue, where the prayers of the day were the psalms that had been read and prayed, and the passage of Scripture was the passage for the day, not some extemporaneous thing. You know, when we read that Christ went into the synagogue and read the passage and spoke, it wasn't one where he said, well, it's been laid on my heart to read so-and-so. Christ himself abided by the liturgy. It said he read the portion for the day. When Peter in the book of Acts was on his way to pray in the synagogue, he didn't just come in and hold forth. He was praying in the Jewish synagogue, which meant a highly liturgical, highly sophisticated, highly developed, ancient tradition that had far more, quote, human tradition than anything you could possibly imagine from a Protestant point of view and would have been totally unfamiliar. And so for this group of people put in a time machine to come into a place in which the focus of the service was the minister and what he said and not the Eucharist, in which the focus of the service was made up words, do whatever you want, say what you want, expound the Scripture any way you want, rather than one of the ancient liturgies of either James or St. John Chrysostom or Basil the Great, all of which, by the way, are far more similar than diverse. They're all Eucharistically centered, and they are all recognizable one to the other. You know your place in each if you know any of those, by the way. Without the focus of worship being on the Eucharist itself, which implied, if you study any church history, church order. Because the minute you see that chalice there and you see a priest serving it, you know he's only going to be serving it to those who are in good standing in the church. So as soon as you see the chalice, you know you have church discipline. In other words, unless you have been to confession, and unless the priest knows who you are, when in the service they say, das didas, the doors, that means the catechumens and the strangers who do not have someone to vouch for them in the body of believers are asked to go out of the church into the narthex and wait, because the church took literally St. Paul's admonition when he said, if you eat and drink this unworthily, you are eating and drinking damnation to yourself, and they wouldn't risk it. And they'd rather offend the visitor than incur on judgment day that person's guilt on their hands. And so the doors, and the doors shut literally, and the visitor was outside, because now we came to the Holy of Holies, and it was not to be trifled with. And had those elements not been there, with all their implications of apostolic order, church discipline, and remember, you couldn't have any church discipline if someone could just say, well, I don't care what my priest tells me, I'm going down the other church down here. Because you see, the church being the church, it wasn't other denominations. All that would happen is that that priest would say, well, I've never seen you before. Where do you come from? Remember, you couldn't have any church discipline if someone could just say, well, I don't care what my priest tells me. I'm going down the other church down here. Because you see, the church being the church, it wasn't other denominations. All that would happen is that that priest would say, well, I've never seen you before. Where do you come from? Well, I come from up the road. And he'd say, well, who here will vouch for you? And someone there would say, I've never seen him. Or they'd say, yeah, we know who he is. He's the guy that wouldn't do what his priest would tell him to do up the street here. And that priest would say, back you go. There's only one church. And you have to be under its discipline. And if you have a complaint, take it to the bishop. But don't come weaseling to me trying to sneak in, taking the gifts of God that only belong to those people in good order, which means accountability to their priests. And so seeing that chalice there didn't just mean that they had a, quote, liturgical style of worship. This wasn't window dressing. It meant far more than that. It meant the discipline, the accountability, the apostolic succession, and everything that went with it. And to come back to my example, without seeing that there, literally, the members of the body of Christ going back to the beginning, whom, by the way, every Protestant at least should know this, would not have access to their Christianity if it was not for their witness. Who do you think all these years passed the gospel down, the Bible, got martyred to pass it down? It was these people. So any Protestant alive today, how much they reject the Orthodox Church, at least has to acknowledge this. Without that discipline, without that accountability, without that notion of apostolic succession, they would have never heard the gospel. Because there never would have been a gospel passed down, faithfully guarded, generation to generation. Books would have been added and subtracted, the way Martin Luther tried to do when he wanted to take certain books out of the Bible, and the way he changed things in his German translation, and the way he dropped certain books from the Old Testament, from the Septuagint, because he didn't want to use the scriptures anymore that Christ and the apostles used in the Old Testament, wanted to leapfrog back to the Hebrew Old Testament, and so on and so forth. So as you look at this, you also have to realize the reverse is true. And that is that as a Protestant, seeing that what we did in the Protestant church would be unrecognizable to generations that had gone before, similarly, at some point, at least someone I had to ask this question, was if that's truly the case, then where does that leave me? And how does that have something to do with my original questions of not feeling that I have the spiritual tools I need to grow as a Christian on the one hand, and on the other hand, that this so-called Christian society of ours is about as anti-Christian, not just un-Christian, as any that has been concocted on earth. And yet, how does it still call itself Christian? Well, let me answer the last first, because it's the easiest. Obviously, if there's no such thing as the church, there's also no such thing as Christianity. There are just different versions of what everybody's idea of what it means to be a personal Christian. And we have reduced and personalized faith to this individualistic expression where it's just you and Jesus in your heart. And Jesus means one thing to one person, to Bishop Spong. Jesus means that homosexual marriage is good. Jesus means that there was no virgin birth. That's the same Jesus, the same Bible. That's how it speaks to his heart. To some fundamentalist Baptist, it means another thing. To some Presbyterian, it means another thing. Well, obviously, if you have no church to defend and define what the very word Christianity means, you obviously, in the end, only have Christians, but you don't have Christianity because there's no common denominator, which is fairly obvious, I imagine. And so, looking beyond that to the personal question, the question then comes, if what is being done in the name of Christianity is not Christianity, and let me hasten to add again, and I'll probably say it three more times before I'm done, because I'll still get somebody who misunderstood the whole thing and raises their hand. It'll be the first question, but don't say I didn't try. I am not talking about salvation, which is a mystery. How was the thief on the cross saved? He wasn't baptized. We don't know where he went to seminary. And Christ said that he would be with him in his kingdom. What's the Roman centurion all about? A Jew, not even a Christian. Christ said he had the most faith in Israel. Only God knows the heart, and God's grace is where you find it, and far be it from a human being to limit that. I am not talking about who is saved any more by magic of being in the church than out of it. We are talking about what is Christianity? What is the church? What does it mean to be a Christian in a verifiable, true way? Having said that, the question that came to me to be very clear at that point was this. And that is that I had to make some sort of a personal decision. Because if the Protestant American experience of Christianity was as far away from the historical church of the beginning as it seemed to me to be, it left me with three alternatives. One, this doesn't matter, because there is no such thing as absolute truth. You just do your thing. If you feel close to God, you are. There's no right or wrong way to do this. Or to put it another way, Cain was right, Abel was wrong. Fruit's okay. Whatever you want to put on the altar, God can ask for a lamb. You do your own thing. That didn't make sense to me. I had been raised in a home that talked about Christian absolutes and the fact it was a historic faith. The second alternative is, we're right, they were wrong. 1,500 years of Christian practice in unbroken continuity, centered on Eucharistic worship, apostolic accountability, sound doctrine, they were all wrong. Nicaea was wrong, which of course also means that our idea of the Trinity is wrong, the two natures of Christ. There's no way to say that Arius wasn't correct, or that Origen wasn't correct, or that the Manichees weren't correct. There's no way to gainsay any of this, because the bishops that did so and argued, it doesn't matter, maybe they were just doing their own thing too, and that's how God spoke to them. It brings you back to this morass. And moreover, the very witness of our own history, if this is the way it's supposed to be, well, you know, count me out. If this is the church, this mess, 23,000 competing denominations with self-contradictory doctrine, if this is the church that Christ said would not be prevailed against, then Christ's definition of prevailed against and the dictionary have real different meanings. It looks mighty prevailed against to me. The third alternative is a very different course and opens up kind of an abyss in front of your feet if you were raised in a Protestant home where even to make the sign of the cross or wear one was a sign of external paganism. It's like a big leap at this point. And that is, maybe I'm looking through the wrong end of the telescope. Maybe the church, historic, has something to teach me. Maybe modern America has a thing or two to learn. Maybe a culture that devalues life at every turn and has lost its way in so many areas of sacramentality, not just in the Eucharist, but just the value of human life alone, should learn humbly from history. Maybe what the church did in unbroken continuity for 1,500 years and still does in the Orthodox community today after 2,000 years is what should be in judgment over us rather than me judging it from the point of view of this kind of proud Protestant egoism where you want your little chapter and verse for everything and you have to be personally convinced because it's all just you, you, you. And of course, once you begin to even entertain that thought and you do some serious reading with any kind of an open mind at all, it seems to me anyway impossible to avoid the fact that you run smack dab into a number of things. And the most basic is this. We in the modern pluralistic world run around and we act as if there are no certainties, but if you study church history, there were certainties, and to be a Christian was something very well understood. We often think it's a feeling. What does it mean to be a Christian? Well, I've accepted Jesus into my heart. What does that really mean in English? It means I feel Christian. It means I'm saying I feel Christian. If you had asked anybody from the early church what it meant to be a Christian, they would have not told you that. I don't exactly presuppose the answer, but if you read the New Testament in the church fathers, here's what it boils down to. They would have told you three things. And now, like a broken record or CD, we've moved on. CDs don't break. What do we say? Okay. Now, like a scratch CD. Let me repeat one more time. I'm talking about what it means to be a Christian, not the mystery of how one is saved. That's a different thing. I'm not judging an individual. I'm not judging a group of people. I'm talking about verifiably what does it mean to be a Christian. Let me clarify that. If one of you say, I am from France, and I say, whereabouts? And you say, I don't know. And I say, oh, that's interesting. Were your parents French? No. You have a French passport? No. Oh, that's interesting. Were you born in France and then you moved when you were little and you forget where you're from? No. And then, not being terribly bright, I'll say, well, did I miss something in there? How do you mean you're from France? Well, I feel French. C'est la vie. Well, that is not going to do at passport control. Let me warn you, the French for those of you who have not been, the French douane do not have a sense of humor. Mais monsieur, je me sens français. Je m'en fous. Okay. End parentheses. I don't want to prefigure the last judgment. It won't be in French anyway. But to come back to the point, if you ask people from the early church, these same people who have no idea where they are in a Protestant worship service, what does it mean to be a Christian? It wasn't a very complicated answer. They would have said basically, and I really mean they all would have said this. They may not have stated it the way I'm going to now, but this is what it boiled down to. It means three things. One, it means you believe certain things. What? Well, let's start with the existence of God and the divinity of Christ. The basic doctrine that every icon of the church, that every liturgy, that every prayer, that every priest, that every peasant, that every literate and illiterate person held in common from the beginning, in all places, in all times. That's what you believe. You didn't have to go to seminary to learn it, but we all knew what it was. Second, it means you do certain things and you don't do other things. Because no matter what you say you believe, if you stand up and recite the creed till you're blue in the face, but you are also running an abortion clinic, routinely committing adultery, and not repenting of either, because we all sin, I hasten to add, those are dramatic sins, but they're no worse than anything I've done. So they're only dramatic for illustrative purposes. We all sin. But are unrepentant of that sin and not moving towards Christ, and not trying to become more like him and less like this abortion clinic operator and adulterer. And if you think that's just fine, and just because you say the creed and you really mean it, that's all you need, no, that's not what it means to be a Christian. Because it's more than belief. In fact, there's even a scripture for this, as the Protestants well know, and that is we're told in scripture that even Satan and the demons believe, all right. They know Jesus is Lord, and they know he rose from the dead. And I guess in that sense, they all accepted him in their hearts. And I don't mean to be facetious, I'm being serious. If acknowledgement of the resurrection of Christ and saying you accept that fact and now you want to be a Christian, if that was it, then Satan is saved at this point. Because there's a second element, it's what you do. Are you moving towards Christ or away from him in this journey called salvation? Because you see, and this is an important parenthesis, there's a big difference between the Protestant view of salvation, which is only a few hundred years old. It's not even the Protestant view of the Reformation. It's the Protestant view of the circuit-riding revivalist of American 19th century Protestantism, this idea of the born-again experience being confused with salvation. Salvation was always seen as a journey in the way that Christ described it. And Paul described it. The narrow way, finishing the race, not letting the seed fall on the dry and stony ground or be choked up by the cares of this life. But there's a third thing, and the very strange thing about the third element, like three legs. In the book, I have a chapter, it's called The Three-Legged Stool. So I say it's like three legs on a stool or three columns on a building. The strange thing about the third thing it always meant, and by the way, still does mean, these things are not up for grabs, it's just a lot of people have forgotten them, of what it means to be a Christian, is the thing that in the whole of church history there is the most unanimity about, and they knew the most about, and it is the thing that we Protestants know the least about, and about which there is the least unanimity. Because most Protestants of a certain ilk will sign on to some sort of doctrine. It's getting fuzzier and fuzzier and fuzzier, and every day you wake up kind of the outrage of the minute in terms of what's been sawed off now. But nevertheless, technically there are certain Protestant doctrines. At least the concept is still around, so that leg is kind of understood. The second one used to be, though with Lutherans and Episcopalians and who knows what, ordaining homosexuals and performing lesbian marriages and calling for the ordination of women and the acceptance of abortion and theologians saying that Christ was not divine, who knows about that, or moral behavior. That leg is teetering. The third leg, however, was sawed off almost immediately after the Reformation, and in our day has literally been put into a wood chipper. It's gone. And yet, it was the leg upon which most people's common faith stood. Believe it or not, it wasn't doctrine, it wasn't moral life. Because both of those things flowed from the first leg, which everybody agreed on, knew the most about, and there was never very much dispute. And that was worship. because the purpose of the Christian life itself was seen to be communion with God. And therefore, if you didn't understand worship, there was no point of doing the other stuff anyway. The reason that you moved towards Christ and lived a certain way was so you could have communion with God in both the limited sense of the Eucharistic feast, but also in the sense of the heart. And the reason the doctrine was important is because it restored you to a direct relationship with God, which expressed itself how? In a feeling? No. In being part of the Christ-bearing community on earth, in communion with its Maker, not as an individual, but as that cloud of witnesses we read of. And the strange thing is, I don't know if some of you here are Sherlock Holmes fans, but I always like Sherlock Holmes stories, or Arthur Conan Doyle stories. Sherlock Holmes didn't write a biography, you know, he's fictitious. For those of you who want to write postcards to Baker Street. But anyway, Arthur Conan Doyle, Sherlock Holmes' character, there's the great mystery of the dog that didn't bark. It was one of these mysteries where the final clue is that a dog didn't bark. Why was that important? Because it was the master's dog. What did that tell Sherlock Holmes? That the master himself broke into his own house, otherwise the dog would have barked. And the fact the servant didn't hear it bark means there's only one person who could get by the dog, and it was the master himself. That was the clue. Liturgy is the great dog of church history that doesn't bark. Because at every period of church history, you read about all kinds of conflict over doctrine. What do you think the great seven ecumenical councils were called for? It was to refute heretics who had strange ideas about what the apostles had taught, and it was to set them straight so they could repent or throw them out of the church, whichever came first. And that's why we still have a Christian faith to hold on to. What do you think happens in confession every time one of us Orthodox goes to our priest? We admit to him that we are not keeping the third leg very well, and we ask for help and prayer, and we repent. And so there's always the internal dispute of our sins. And if you read the great literature of the church that comes basically from its nuns and its monks and its saints and its martyrs, and you read the great prayers of the church, many, many, many of them are prayers like the psalmist prayers of what? Repentance. Because the second leg is always broken and teetering, along with our characters and our sinfulness. And so you read, the dog barks a lot on that leg. But the third thing is taken for granted. I'm always amused when I'm debating abortionists in this country, and they tell me, abortion's no big deal. Look, before Roe v. Wade, nobody even talked about it. Well, of course not, because it was illegal, and murder, it was taken for granted, was a bad thing. And only when it became an issue do you have all kinds of literature and people picketing abortion clinics. Well, similarly, when you read church history, you read the liturgies and the prayers, but you don't read much dissent on what they were, because even the heretics did not question what was obviously received from the beginning and was unquestioned. I'm not saying there was no questions, but it's very rare. Why? Because people disputed over doctrine, people disputed over moral practice, but everybody knew the liturgy by heart. They'd been doing it from the beginning. Everybody knew the prayers of the Old Testament by heart. Everybody knew the Psalms. Everybody knew that to pray was to pray the cycle of the Psalms. Everybody knew what the basics of Christian life were, because that was their contact. These were not a bunch of Bible-reading fundamentalists. These were mostly illiterate people who were taught through the liturgy itself. It was their Bible, not just before the New Testament canon closed, but long afterwards. And so the one thing everybody understood very basically was worship. So how odd to fast forward to our own period of history and find that we are sawing through the last leg now, which is doctrine. Moral practice has been out the window for most of this century in terms of moral certainties, whatever we may fool ourselves into thinking, and worship hasn't been understood since Zwingli and Martin Luther and the early reformers began to monkey with the sacrament of the Mass in the West, which we would call the liturgy and the Eucharist in the East. And the fact of the matter is, then, that when you start looking through this telescope from the right way around, you realize that the thing that was the most common property of everyone in the church is what has been lost first in the Protestant community. One of the most moving things I remember for me personally when I started going to some Orthodox liturgies was the fact that babies and little children would come forward and take the Eucharist. And I can remember being stunned by this because I come from a Calvinist background where, hey, the age of accountability is everything. You got to nail it down. Are you accountable or not? And then the whole idea of predestination is everything. And the elect are the elect, and then the in double predestination, those that aren't elect were created for damnation, so we know where they fit in anyway. Tough breaking the news to them, but we know where they stand. And everybody has a place and a thing, and it's clean, and you think, and it's all true, and you have to know where you are, and you say your thing, and it's by the numbers. And then you come into an Orthodox church, what's this? A two-year-old dragging a teddy bear, coming along in his little brother's wake, and the mother's got a baby and that she's been breastfeeding in the narthex, and now here they come, and it's going to receive the Eucharist. And I can remember an old monk I met once told me, when I was still in my combative and questioning mode on all this, I said, well, you know, what is this with giving children? I mean, you give children the Eucharist? He said, well, what's wrong with that? And I said, well, they can't understand what's happening. You know, I'm the Western rationalist. You've got to understand everything. How do they know what they're doing? And how do they understand what the Eucharist means? And he looked at me and he says, well, do you? And of course, that's kind of an interesting reply. Because precisely the difference between rationalism and the reductionist Protestant way of doing things and the Orthodox Church, the most basic difference is this. The Orthodox Church has room for what it calls, literally, as well as in a spiritual sense, the holy mysteries. What does that mean? That they are irrational, berserk things that are like magic? No. It is that, to put it in simple terms, you small, God big. Protestantism, particularly Calvin got it wrong. He said, me big too. In fact, I'm sending God a memo. I'm going to help him figure out who's saved, who's lost, and how to do it. And it better fit in with the five, points from the Council of Dort, or we may just go get ourselves another God, which of course they did. Because the real God will not be mocked, and the real God truly is beyond our comprehension, and that's why Orthodox theology is called apophatic, which is the art of what you don't say. It may surprise you after listening to me for an hour that I like Orthodox theology. Imagine a church that tells you to shut up once in a while. It's like a nightmare. More gracious. But the whole idea being that to put it this way, for those of us familiar with our scripture, the concept of the Holy of Holies has been preserved. And if you remember, in the Holy of Holies, when the priest went in once a year, they tied a rope around his leg. Must have given him a funny feeling, by the way. And, you know, why are you doing that? Because if you die in there, that's the Holy of Holies. We ain't going to go get you. We're just going to haul you out. So pull on that thing once in a while, or we're just going to pull you out here. Why? Because the Holy of Holies was the Holy of Holies. End of discussion. And a line is drawn across, and that's it. So when it comes to the holy mysteries, when it comes to how the real presence of Christ is in the wine and the bread, when it comes to how we are saved in terms of how grace operates, when it comes to all those wonderful areas of forgiveness and mercy and love and how they intermingle with the idea of how God has foreknown things. What the amazing thing is that you will find when you read Maximus the Confessor, for instance, or you go through the Philokalia, the saying of the Desert Fathers, is what they don't say. Because in Protestantism, following the Western rationalist mind, we're so used to everything tapped down, nailed down, circled twice, the old belt and suspenders ploy, plus some. Everything tapped down. And that, of course, comes right out of the Roman Catholic heresy in the scholastic movement, where people like Thomas Aquinas decided to write the map for God, as it were. And, of course, the other Western rationalists like John Calvin and Martin Luther were only too happy to follow along and make the map even more severe. Orthodoxy, for those of you not familiar with it, you will be amazed at what is not said. And you will be amazed that you come to a place where it truly is the mystery of salvation. And the Holy of Holies are the Holy of Holies. And that means someone's not going to give you an explanation beyond saying, this is a mystery. And they may say it 100 different ways, but in the end it will come to that. And so, to conclude tonight, I'll just finish on a personal note. When I became Orthodox, for me, therefore, the discovery was very much through the back door. Talk about the operation of grace. I stumbled into the hospital of the soul, having no idea I was even there until I kind of looked around in the emergency room, as it were. Because I came completely backwards. I wasn't looking for the church. I was trying to understand why I didn't first feel satisfied with my Protestantism, and then why it was the early church seemed so different, and what conclusion I could draw. Came a day when I decided that if there was any kind of last pitiful remnant, some shred left of the historical church, that I would rather have, you know, one brick of it left in my hand, that I could say, yes, this is authentic, than the biggest facade of a 20,000-member church you could mention. If I could find one monk or one priest or one faithful person anywhere who would tell me what this was, that you could still be this, that you could still be a Christian connected to Ignatius and Polycarp and Clement, that these liturgies of Chrysostom and the others were still being performed anywhere, if I could hear this anywhere, maybe even just buy the cassette, I would do it. And I was literally ignorant of the fact that there was an alternative. And so for about 4 or 5 years, I started attending, in kind of equal proportions, various Episcopal churches and various Roman Catholic churches. And what I discovered was Protestantism, pressed down and running over. I never went to a real Roman Catholic church anywhere. Why? Because they were all different. And the one thing I had learned about the liturgy of the ancient church was it was always the same. I went to one Roman Catholic church, and there was a nun in a miniskirt handing out balloons and playing a guitar. And that was their liturgy. And then somebody tossed some wafers around, and it was served by the kids. So, well, I can do this in my local Episcopal church where, you know, for all I knew, they were sacrificing black chickens on the altar that Sunday in a festival to the great goddess of creation or something. Who knew? I remember being in St. John's of the Divine in New York one Sunday because a friend of mine was commissioned to do a massive painting there. And they had the Earth Day liturgy. And lo and behold, a flock of geese come up the nave. This is true, not apocryphal. And they served the geese the Eucharist. And I had just been reading the ancient liturgy where it said, das diras, and the doors would shut to prevent people from eating, drinking damnation to themselves. You know, and here the Episcopals are handing the Eucharist out to a flock of geese, and I'm thinking, I guess not. No, let me see. What have we got here? And whatever it wasn't anything I had been reading about. This, I had a feeling, was not what went on Easter morning when St. John Chrysostom preached his great homily. I had a feeling it wasn't Earth Day in Constantinople on that day. So, to me, aside from the historical problems with the papacy and all the rest of it, the actual condition of American modern Catholicism, without getting into the history and theology of the papacy, which I do, one last plug for my book, in my book, obviously I didn't want to jump out of the frying pan into the fire. People say, well, what do you mean out of the frying pan into the fire? It's just a personal choice, isn't it? And I try to explain that being the son of Francis Schaeffer is kind of like this, and that is that for me to become Orthodox, was kind of like the son of the late revered Ayatollah Khomeini to suddenly decide to be a rabbi. as Jeeves would say, the contingency is remote. And it will be fraught with difficulty. And fraught it was. So I wasn't going to do this frivolously. You know, I can get someone in a lapsed nun in a miniskirt to hand out a balloon on Times Square to me if I want. I don't need to do it inside a church and upset everybody. So my search had to continue, and I kind of drew a blank. Then Jim, sitting over there in his short sleeves, God bless him, my oldest and best friend, who I've been making film productions with since I think I was 3 and he was 12, he was kind of drawing a blank at the same time. And we both were drawing blanks together, coast-to-coast blankness. I was in Massachusetts, and he was up in California, in Los Gatos, in Silicon Valley, and we would call up and commiserate. When was the last time you were in church? About 3 months ago. What happened? Well, they're playing guitars again. You know, I didn't like Peter, Paul, and Mary the first time around. And I hate them with Christian words even worse. Okay, sign the phone out. We were getting very grumpy. So we would trade information like this. And one day, a guy talked to me, and I was talking about Jim, and this guy said to me, talk about a convoluted circumstance. And I, by the way, was not looking at the Orthodox Church at all. I was just getting disillusioned with modern American Catholicism. He said to me, your friend Jim, where does he live again? I said, Los Gatos. He says, that's near Ben Lomond. And I said, yeah, I don't know. Is it? Yeah, it's just down the street. Why? What's Ben Lomond got to do with the price of eggs? Well, they've got a great Orthodox Church there. A what? An Orthodox Church. If you're looking for the ancient church and you like liturgy and that stuff, I think is the way this guy put it, he'd love that because they're doing all that stuff down there. So I called Jim up. I think I have this right. And I said, I heard something interesting. Don't go to that Roman Catholic church on the hill next Sunday. Check this out for us. There's this thing called Orthodoxy. Go down the street. They got one in Ben Lomond. I don't know if there are other ones. I think you live near the only one. So I told him. Because the guy said you were real lucky to be there. I think there's one left. And you live there. So check it out. Because there are none where I live. And you got to go look there and tell it and come back, report back. So Jim went down to the church in Ben Lomond. And to cut a long story short, became Orthodox. As he walked in the door virtually, because this is what he had been reading and studying and praying and longing about, as I had. And then he got on the phone to me. And this is two guys who were trading horror stories for years on why they weren't going to church. He says, you got to come out to California. And I said, why is that? Have we got a new movie deal going or something? You know, did my agent finally decide to pay me? What's happening? And he said, no, you got to go to church. So, well, you know, I'm kind of sick of churches. I don't go to church anymore. Each one's worse than the last. What do you mean I got to go to church? I'm not flying to California to go to church. He said, no, you got, trust me on this one. The last time he said that, he lost a lot of money. Anyway, so in the end, he persisted, and I came out to Ben Lomond. And spent a number of days there talking with some of the priests. But the talk was all very interesting, and I got some interesting answers. But the thing that amazed me was, starting with the morning prayers at the St. John of Kronstadt house, and then going to the liturgies, was that the church I had read about was alive. You know, if you've seen that film Jurassic Park, there's this guy who's been studying dinosaurs all his life, and he thought it was a bunch of bones. And, you know, he'd never seen one, obviously, because dinosaurs are extinct. And then all of a sudden, he gets to this island, and one lopes past. What was that? And the movie's interesting at that point. You know, the scientist is so moved. I mean, it's not science anymore. All of a sudden, he has the awe of a little child. And I walked into St. Peter, St. Paul, and Ben Lomond, which is an Antiochian church there. And for me, it was really an amazing thing, because first of all, the liturgy is always the liturgy, and you have to have a heart of stone not to be moved by it, or be truly a creature of this century and depraved to the limit. I mean, I can't imagine anybody with the least spark that wouldn't sense something. But to have been reading about something for 6 or 7 years as history, not only that, 2,000-year-old history, St. Irenaeus and Ignatius, Eusebius in his festal oration at the church at Tyre, where they have bits and pieces of the liturgy, you can read it. And to have been convinced that everything like Ezekiel is vanity, vanity, and everything is corrupt, and everything is hopeless, and it's just me against the world, and I am alone. Because that had been my conclusion. It was, I am alone. I am trying to find truth, and it does not exist. If it existed, it's only in my mind. It's just me and my pitiful history books and a bunch of notes, and I can't find it. I'm looking, I cannot find it. No one is doing it. The dinosaurs are dead. The era is past. And to walk in there and to see that it was alive was a shocking experience for me, of which I was immediately suspicious, thinking, first of all, what's wrong with this picture? A, it's in California. Because I was brought up in Switzerland, and the furthest east I decided to live was Newburyport, Mass., which is clinging to the Atlantic coast. First of all, it's in California. So probably, this thing is probably funded, you know, by Shirley MacLaine or something. She must like this. My second thought was, this can't be real. This is like some deal where a bunch of guys like me, where Father Weldon and these people are just like I was, say, 15 years ago. They read all this stuff, and they sat down one day and they said, we'll cook it all, we'll get it going again. We'll pretend we're dinosaurs. We're going to dress up in dragon outfits and run around saying, I'm a dinosaur. We're going to just start it up again. Strap on a robe, look at the mosaics in Ravenna, make some sketches, so I'll get my wife to sew me one of them things. And we'll just get it going again. Get it out of a library. But if you've studied the apostolic succession, of course, once it's broken, it's over. So you can't fake it. In other words, if this was just play acting, it was worse than nothing. Talk about being deluded. The whole premise of the ancient tradition is that it's the ancient tradition unbroken, and all the fathers of the church scream about this. Ignatius of Antioch on the way to martyrdom, his seven letters to the churches in Asia, treat the bishop as if he were Christ. The truth that has been handed to us, received from the apostles. Eusebius, every time he mentions an important bishop, listing the bishops back to the beginning. History mattered to the church. So if it's just a bunch of guys in Ben Lomond play acting, it's worse than nothing. Now we're really up the creek. This is like Pirates of the Caribbean in Disneyland. There are no pirates there. These are just audio animatronic figures. Smart programming, but there's nothing here. Then, as I began to read Orthodox material and started to be introduced to people like Meyendorf and Schmemann and the others of contemporary writers, and that I began to connect the dots up of Orthodox view of history, I got very excited. Because I realized that this was not some fakery going on, that what these men had plugged into was pre-existing with an unbroken link. And that there was a bishop out there wandering around, an Antiochian bishop as it might be, in this case Philip Saliba, whose own ordination is rooted back into Antioch, where there had been a continuous presence there in the Middle East, and the Jerusalem church before it, all the way back until Peter, who went to Antioch first, by the way, before he went to Rome, that's history, had founded the church. And this wasn't just a bunch of Californians putting sandals on and robes and running around trying to do something authentic, quote unquote. They had been ordained by a bishop who could show me his list. This was the real thing. And then it blew my mind. At that point, it was just, how do I become Orthodox? And I remember when I got back to Newburyport, Massachusetts, still not knowing much about Orthodoxy, I asked Father Weldon before I left, I said, is there an Orthodox church in Newburyport? And the way I meant it was kind of like anywhere around Boston. He must have meant specifically, because he said, I don't know. And me being completely ignorant of Orthodoxy in America, what I heard him saying was, I don't know if there are any Orthodox churches on the East Coast. Which isn't what he said. But I thought, well, I'll go back and look. And he said, you'll have to look. There are different jurisdictions. There's Russian, there's Antiochian, there's Greek. It's all the same Orthodox church, same liturgy. It's just the historical happenstance of how these churches came from the various immigrant countries. But you'll have to look. So I remembered the Greek part. And I knew there were a lot of Greeks in our area. So I opened our yellow pages. And I looked under Greek, and it was like, import-export, olive oil, cheese, olives. And then finally it was Greek Orthodox Church. So I called the number up, and I got Father Chris, who's now my priest, but he wasn't then, on the phone, and he must have thought he had a real wacko on the phone, because it said Greek something, and, you know, it's all Greek to me, that's a phrase in the English language, I didn't know, so I said very loudly, as if speaking to a very simple, small child, and he answered the phone, hello? Do you speak English? Well, he did, you know, because having been an Air Force captain in the Strategic Air Command for 10 years. Plus, well, and that doesn't mean anything, by the way, the Air Force captain part, but he had gone to a good private school. You see, he hadn't done his whole education in our public school system, so he could speak his own language. And he said, yes, I speak English. And I can imagine him looking at his wife, Presbyterian Tara, going like this. We really have one today. So he speaks English. So I got kind of confused, and this is, you talk about a weird way of looking at things. We're in Newburyport, I'm an American, this is a Greek church. So what I said to him next was, do you let foreigners come to your church? There was a kind of a long silence. And he said, where are you calling from? So I just live across the river. I'm 2 minutes from the church. So he told me that, yes, he spoke English. Yes, foreigners could come to his church. When I went to the Greek Orthodox Church in Newburyport, the thing that amazed me the most, and amazed me much more than my experience in Ben Lomond, by the way, because I couldn't have known, was that it was exactly the same. It was a Greek Orthodox church, and the Ben Lomond had been Antiochian, full of converts, a lot of English being spoken and so on. The church in Newburyport was Greek, a more ethnic community, about 75% of the liturgy in English, the rest in Greek, so you could say, quote, foreign. Hey, I was home free. It was the liturgy of St. John Chrysostom. A priest was standing there facing the altar and not entertaining the people. There was the chalice. It was the same prayers, the same liturgy. The Andiderou was being handed out. It was the same thing. And you can't imagine, unless you come from a Protestant background, what that means. Because if you've ever church shopped, quote unquote, as a Protestant, the one thing you know is nothing's the same. I remember growing up in the Presbyterian denomination, and you know, it always came down to the pastor. Well, he's a good man. Well, they had a good pastor, but he left, and the new man, he isn't quite so sound. Because it was all the man or the seminary he went to. It was never the church. The Christ-bearing community on earth was not a concept that existed. The church was in your own heart. The church was the building you went to, and the quality of the service depended on the quality of the man. If you had a liberal, then it was apostate. If he was conservative, it was good. If the church had split, you had to figure out which side you went with. But to go from coast to coast and find anything remotely the same was wild, especially for someone who had been hopping around Episcopal churches and Roman Catholic churches where you had everything from the Tridentine Mass to statements by Marxist-Leninists on Hitler's birthday, for all I knew. And all points in between, literally. I mean, catch as catch can, like rolling a handful of dice every Sunday. So to find it the same, and then I thought, well, that's a fluke. I found two good Orthodox churches. But of course, you know, they're in a sea of apostasy, because isn't everybody? So I'll go to Boston. I said, I know the one that won't be any good. I know. I'll find the one right next to Harvard. You tell me there's an Orthodox church mainly filled with students from Harvard Divinity School or MIT and Harvard, and I'll tell you what kind of church that'll be. I knew. So I went down to St. Mary's Antiochian Church next to Harvard, and they were doing the same thing, unadulterated. The altar was clean, the chalice pure, the liturgy intact. The priest wasn't entertaining people. It was still a liturgy. And that's when I began to be very, very intrigued and serious and started talking to my priest about being chrismated, because it was the consistency and the witness of the unbroken tradition that was the same everywhere as it had been since the beginning from the history that I had been reading, or the very definition of the holy tradition, which is those things believed by Christians in all places at all times since the beginning. That is the holy tradition. And here I had found that in the United States, of all places, a culture that corrupts everything it touches, including the kind of Disneyfication of its own history, our culture is masterful at trivializing everything it touches.